This is Macro Voices, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Macro Voices episode 378 was produced on June 1st, 2023. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. The 2023 In Gold We Trust report is out, so in keeping with Macro Voices' standing tradition, its principal author, Ronnie Stoeffele, returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss all things precious metals, from the fundamental outlook to the likely possibility of an even deeper correction than we've already seen so far, before the yellow metal makes an assault on new all-time highs in U.S. dollar terms.
And I'm Patrick Ceresna with the Macro Scoreboard week over week. As of the close of Wednesday, May 31st, 2023, the S&P 500 was up 155 basis points, closing at 4190. We'll take a closer look at that chart and the key technical levels to watch in the post-game segment. The U.S. dollar index up 34 basis points, closing at 104.23. The dollar continues to strengthen off of the lows. The July WTI crude oil contract down 841 basis points to 68.09. New rounds of selling open the window for testing those 2023 lows. We'll look at that chart with Eric in the post-game segment. Gold up 87 basis points to 1982. Many looking to see if gold has put in a short-term low. Copper up 225 basis points, closing at 364, bouncing off those recent lows. Uranium up 74 basis points to 54.60, continues to hold the breakout and press new highs on the year. The U.S. 10-year Treasury yield down 8 basis points, closing at 367 points. The key news to watch this week is Friday's jobs numbers, and next week we have the ISM Services PMI, the Bank of Canada rate statement, and the Treasury currency report. This week's feature interview guest is Incrementum Fund Manager Ronnie Stoeffele. Eric, why did we get Ronnie back on the show this week?
Well, Patrick, having Ronnie on the show when the In Gold We Trust report is released each spring has become a Macro Voices tradition. But it's especially relevant this year because I really think it's an important time in the gold market. Of course, you know, I could be wrong, but I think the fundamentals are in place for a breakout to new all-time highs. And I think if we can clear 2120 or so and stay there for a week or two, I think it really sets up a technical picture for a big advance up to at least 2500, maybe even 3000 within the next 12 months. So I think it's a really important time to be on top of the gold market. Ronnie writes one of the most respected reports in the entire industry, so the time was right.
Well, Eric's interview with Ronnie is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
If you invest to bring about a world powered by green energy, you should meet Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy that serves as a one-stop shop for green energy investors in Europe. Respect Energy brings together independent power producers, accredited and institutional investors holding assets in renewables, or undertaking investments in new green energy production, such as wind and solar photovoltaic power plants. More than 600 institutional and accredited investors have already entrusted Respect Energy with the sale of their electricity production, portfolio management, O&M services, EPC, and project development. If you want to invest in green energy in Europe with the help of a trusted partner, contact Respect Energy today and ask for a tailor-made solution. For more information, visit respect.energy.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's your host, Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Ronnie Stoeffele, principal author of the In Gold We Trust report and fund manager at Incrementum. Ronnie, it happens each spring, and it's that time of year. The In Gold We Trust report is out. Listeners, you'll find the download link for the full report, as well as a slide deck that Ronnie prepared to accompany today's interview. Both of those links are in your Research Roundup email. Ronnie, let's start with just the big picture for people who might not be familiar with the report, which is kind of the event of the season in the precious metals world. How did this thing come into existence? Who's behind it? What's the motive for it? What's the purpose of it? What will people find in the report? And what's new and interesting, and what's maybe the most exciting thing this year?
Hi, Eric. Thanks for having me. And yeah, you said my name almost perfectly. So it's a tough name for English speakers, but you're getting better every year, so congrats. Well, I started publishing this report already 17 years ago, and it's an annual report, and over the years it became bigger and bigger, and now it's probably one of the most widely followed publications on gold. And you know, the problem is that it's not about gold, it's trying to understand everything, you know, opportunity costs, equity markets, inflation, debt, then of course where interest rates are heading, geopolitical stuff, this whole de-dollarization discussion. Then we talk about mining stocks, technical analysis. We've got a chapter on the cracker boom. We've got a chapter about narratives and how narratives are created. We've got a chapter, you know, about this civil war in the sound money community, gold versus Bitcoin. Then, of course, we've got two exclusive interviews, one with my dear friend Russell Napier and another one with Zoltán Pozsar. And the leitmotif of this year's report is showdown, because we're seeing three different showdowns at the moment. First of all, the showdown when it comes to central banks versus, let's say, the real economy. So central bankers, after raising interest rates that aggressively over the last year, they are facing not a dilemma, but rather a trilemma between, you know, fighting inflation, then on the other hand, avoiding a recession or a hard landing, and then on the other hand, financial market stability, especially in the banking space. So this is the first showdown, and we clearly are in the recession camp. The second showdown is when it comes to geopolitics. I mean, this de-dollarization topic that folks like Luke Roman are talking about for ages already, this is now really becoming mainstream. And therefore, we dedicated two big chapters to that topic. Also to the topic how important emerging markets nowadays are for the gold space. And I think, Eric, we in the Western world, we think we are, you know, London, New York, that's the center of the gold world. Actually, it's not. The price of gold is more and more being made in Shanghai, in India, in emerging markets in general. So therefore, we took a deep dive and analyzed what's actually going on in emerging markets when it comes to gold demand, but also when it comes to the infrastructure in the gold space. And then the third showdown is actually for the gold price itself. You know, gold has made new all-time highs in basically every currency, but in US dollar terms, we've been flirting with new all-time highs, and now we're like $100 below. I have to tell you, the feeling that I have is in the gold community, it's, you know, it seems that general investors couldn't care less, and many gold bucks have thrown in the towel. So this quite negative sentiment, in combination with the price that is only slightly below its all-time highs, I think that's a pretty, pretty good setup. So that's basically what the report is all about. We've got a chapter about CapEx. We've got a chapter about our own recession indicator that we've built. We take a deep dive to the topics of inflation, debt developments. We do technical analysis. So it's a longish read, 420 pages, but I think it's worth taking the time.
Let's dive into the fundamentals driving precious metals markets. Something changed dramatically November 6th of last year. I've heard from a few of our other guests on Macro Voices what they think that something was. It happened to be the same day that interest rates peaked. But clearly, that was the bottom of a long bear market or cyclical bear market that we had in gold. It was then straight up for a while, got back, tested all-time highs, actually did trade to a brand new all-time high for all of about 37 seconds. And now we're about $100 lower. So what's driving this? Is it about real interest rates? Is it about inflation? What's going on?
Well, I think it's all about this narrative that has been created, that Jay Powell is the new Paul Volcker, and I said a while ago that he should be nominated for the Academy Awards, and if Jay Powell is the new Paul Volcker, then Danny DeVito is the new Brad Pitt. So I just don't buy into that narrative. And if we have a look at track records of central bankers over the last couple of years, I still wonder why so many people still actually believe in the forecasts being made by central bankers. But I think that we have definitely over the last couple of quarters. I mean, let's take a step back. I think nobody, I don't know any strategist, no analyst, no fund manager actually who forecasted that significant rise in interest rates. I didn't see that coming. I don't know anybody who really forecasted well that interest rates will rise more than 4 percentage points within 12 months. However, I think that now over the last couple of months, market participants have actually realized that the end of the rate hike cycle is coming closer and closer. But I think that the majority of investors are still what I think Gabe called them pessimistic bulls. So they hope for a soft landing, for a mild recession to see the pivot by the Federal Reserve. And I don't really buy into that because, first of all, if we analyze what's coming in terms of economic indicators, and you had a brilliant show recently about the recessionary drivers, and we're definitely also in the recession camp. You know, it's the leading economic indicator. It's a yield curve, obviously. It's the labor market that is weakening significantly. It's the ISM. So I think that a recession is definitely our base case. Now, if we have a look at the majority of economic forecasts, we had that based on Bloomberg data. So while many people think it's the most anticipated recession ever, I've heard that quite a lot, the analyst consensus kind of speaks a different language. So the majority of analysts thinks that there will be a slowdown in growth, but nobody is really seeing a hard landing. So, for example, out of 100 analysts that are questioned by Bloomberg, the forecast for this year is still growth at 1%, and only 4 out of 100 analysts believe that we will hit the recession in 2023. For the next year, it's 13 out of 93 analysts. And none of those analysts is expecting a severe recession, despite this massive monetary tightening that we're seeing, not only on the interest rate side, but also when it comes to credit tightening, also when it comes to quantitative tightening. So clearly, I don't buy into this narrative that it's the most anticipated recession. If you have a look at the positioning, I think it's not. If you like have a look at analyst consensus, it's not. So therefore, I think that a hard landing is still clearly a minority view. And therefore, we crunch the numbers and analyze what actually works best over the course of a recession. And this is the result is our incrementum recession model, where we said, okay, every recession has different stages, and then crunched the numbers and researched which asset classes work best in every stage of the recession. And you know, that's kind of a summary based on the last recession since 1971. Actually, gold is a pretty decent recession hedge, while equities, for example, they only work as soon as, the reflation really starts happening. So this is normally the point in time when everybody starts panicking. And what do we see usually during that stage? Well, actually, we see massive fiscal stimulus and monetary stimulus. So in the earlier stages, I think that you want to be overweight gold. You want to be underweight mining stocks. You want to be underweight commodities, but also silver.
You say underweight mining stocks. Let's touch on that. In the past, you know, people have always pointed out, boy, the mining stocks are lagging. There's your opportunity. You want to dive on the mining stocks because that's your chance to still get in. You know, it hasn't made the move up. You're saying the opposite. Stay away from them. What's going on there?
I would say from a technical point of view, I think it's now too early to to really start to build a massive position in the mining space. And you can see, you know, if you have a look in the sector, you see that the risk appetite is still pretty low. What do I mean by that? Well, have a look at Franco Nevada, have a look at Silver Wheaton, for example. So those large royalty and streaming companies, they are pretty close to their all-time high. So they are doing pretty well because they are being regarded as the most conservative stocks in the mining space. Then if you have a look at three major producers, so Newmont, Barrick, and Agnico, they're still between 30 and almost 50% below their all-time highs. So this is telling me, well, actually, the market doesn't really appreciate the leverage that the producers have. And then if you have a look at developers, if you have a look at juniors, well, there are some really good names, some really good stories out there, stocks that have done tremendously well recently. But I don't see too much risk appetite. And you know, we are seeing so many factors that actually influence the mining space at the moment. Of course, cost of capital. Then we're seeing resource nationalism, what's going on in Chile, what's going on in Mexico recently. Then, of course, we're seeing that risk appetite in equity markets is still not really there. And then we see that, well, you know, as I've said before, if you have a look at the gold space, for example, well, institutional investors and I would say that Western financial investors can be kind of analyzed via the numbers of the ETFs. So gold ETFs were down a bit last year. This year, starting in March and then in April, we saw some modest inflows. But this is telling me that, well, you know, still many market participants are on the sidelines when it comes to gold. When it comes to gold mining equities, I think we're not there yet. So from my point of view, it's now time to work on your selection, do your homework, start buying into some quality names. But I think we're far away from, you know, a big mania in the junior mining space yet. Yeah, that's going to happen at some point, but this is just way too early.
Ronnie, different people have different views on what's going to happen next with respect to inflation. But for those of us who think that a new secular inflation trend is already upon us, it pretty much spells a certain showdown coming in monetary policy, because at some point what happens is you start to see inflation running away. The Fed must hike interest rates in order to fight inflation. Yet at the same time, if you're having a dislocation in the stock market, as a lot of people think would happen under those circumstances, the Fed must cut in order to save the market. Well, if you must do two opposite things at the same time, you're screwed. What happens when they're screwed? Not only which one do they choose, but you know, at that point, what are the potential consequences?
Well, yeah, I agree that they're screwed, and there's only, let's say, lesser evils, and I think, you know, as I've said before, I think that the Fed kind of regained quite a lot of credibility over the last year, and I'm pretty certain that they will lose quite a lot of credibility over the next couple of quarters. But I think, you know, this narrative of Jay Powell, and you know, I'm not the biggest fan of the ECB. Obviously, they have been acting like, you know, as flexible as an anvil in free fall when it comes to inflation. You know, they told us that it's transitory and it's only a hump and so on for forever. And then they reacted very, very late. And you know, Dave Rosenberg he said that quite recently. It's the same old game, yeah. First they overease and they over-tighten, and now we're obviously in the over-tightening environment. But I would say that, first of all, clearly for the time being, disinflationary drivers are much stronger. So we see that, first of all, recessions are extremely disinflationary. Then we, of course, see the base effect kicking in. We see that, you know, commodity prices have come down significantly. We saw that, you know, tapping the SPR was clearly disinflationary. Energy prices have stabilized. If you have a look at break-even rates, yeah, disinflation is the name of the game at the moment. However, If we have a look at the longer term game, and I would say that this is kind of this game between inflation and deflation, it's like a tug of war. We once published a book almost 10 years ago. It was called Austrian School for Investors, Austrian Investing Between Inflation and Deflation. And I think, you know, over this period of the Great Moderation, 4 decades basically, inflation for a portfolio manager was, you know, not important at all in the Western world, not important at all if you want to structure a portfolio. Now I think that inflation is really becoming much, much more important for your asset allocation. A similar setup like in high inflation countries, yeah, where for them, you know, if you want to structure a portfolio, if you want to prepare it for the future, well, inflation and inflation volatility has always been central for your decisions. But if we have a look at this tug of war between inflation and deflation, I think there is not too many deflationary drivers left anymore. Obviously, if you have a look at M2 growth, which is falling for the first time basically on a yearly basis since the 1930s, this is one of my favorite recession indicators, probably. So money supply growth is clearly telling us, well, this is disinflation, and it goes hand in hand with my call for recession. But then on the other hand, we are seeing that, you know, global supply chains, they have kind of normalized. And then, you know, the big topic out there, technology and innovation, especially artificial intelligence, yeah, ChatGPT, that's a major disinflationary or deflationary force. And I think we all have a kind of a view on that, yeah, but it's going to impact markets tremendously over the next couple of years. And it's a disinflationary driver. However, I think that medium to longer term inflationary dynamics are becoming stronger and stronger. We're seeing, for example, you know, wars are always inflationary, unfortunately, and it seems that the Ukraine war, but also some other regions that are highly fragile at the moment, you know, we're kind of moving into a fourth turning environment. Then, of course, you know, the whole greenflation that we're seeing. Yes, I mean, we're seeing some sort of a Cubanization of Europe at the moment. And we try to, you know, spend gazillions to fight climate change. Of course, it has significant costs. And if you have a look at, for example, at energy prices, yeah, in Germany, well, if you want to be competitive as an industrial nation, obviously energy costs are quite important. So this is definitely another inflationary driver. Then we're seeing, of course, demographics. We're seeing that the supply of labor is declining. We're seeing that demand for labor is rising. And it's driving up wages. We're seeing this cost-wage spiral. Then another big driver is deglobalization and you know, reshoring, friendshoring, whatever you want to call it. So from my point of view, we should brace for higher inflation volatility going forward. We should brace for another inflation wave as soon as this inflation wave is over. And I think that what's going to happen then? Well, actually, if inflation rates continue to come down, then I think that central bankers will basically say, well, congrats, we did a great job in fighting inflation. The recessionary clouds will get darker and darker. And then obviously they will start becoming much more aggressive on the monetary side, but also on the fiscal side. And I think they will become too dovish too early and then basically prepare the foundation for the next inflationary wave. So that's basically our forecast, disinflation for the short term, and then another inflation wave. So therefore, I think that hedging against inflation is probably, it's still very, very cheap. And I think that most asset managers that have never really navigated through an inflationary environment, they're still in this great moderation thinking and think, well, actually, we go back to the great moderation. We took a big hit in 2022, but now everything is going back to normal. I don't think we're going back into this great moderation environment for the next couple of years.
Ronnie, way back in 2009, I wrote an article describing Sergei Glazyev, the Russian scholar who has proposed what he described as a de-dollarization campaign. And I was really trying to persuade people that this was worth paying attention to. And oh boy, was I ridiculed and mocked, you know. Retired computer geek pretends to be a finance guy and totally misses it, doesn't get it, doesn't understand that the US dollar is guaranteed to be the center of the universe forever, just like the people thought that the pound sterling was going to be that. Well, it's true that I was way early, but wow, look at what's going on. In 2018, I wrote a book predicting that Russia and China might jointly work together to assert a global digital reserve currency backed by precious metals. Seems like there's an awful lot of Chinese and Russian gold accumulation. Do you think they're planning something?
You know, I think it's just a process. It's a process that has heated up over the last couple of months, and definitely the sanctions against the Russians, you know, they were an important catalyst, because if the Western world basically with the stroke of a pen can say, well, you know, your currency reserves are worthless, then you're probably going to change your playbook. And I think that, you know, if you want to diversify out of the US dollar and out of treasuries, you need something that is highly liquid, that has a low bid-ask spread, that is traded, you know, 24/7, that is accepted all over the globe, and something that doesn't have any counterparty risk. And I think gold plays a vital role in that. And therefore, I think it's no coincidence that in 2022, we saw a new all-time high when it comes to central bank gold demand. It's no coincidence that now China and Russia have announced again that they continue to buy gold. It's no coincidence that there are, I think, 17 nations now wanting to join the BRICS. So therefore, I think, you know, this game is really picking up momentum. You quoted Russian finance minister Glasyev, and he said, for example, gold along with silver has been the core of the global financial system for millennia, an equivalent, an honest measure of the value of paper money and assets. So I think that all those nations in the BRICS, in the emerging markets, in the SCO, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, well, first of all, they're quite significant when it comes to central bank gold demand. They're quite significant gold producers, China and India, China and Russia being now the top two producers. And also when it comes to consumer demand, they are pretty important. So 50% of all consumer demand is coming from China and from India. If you have a look at, you know, what India imported over the last 20 years, they imported 31,000 tons of gold. You know, those combined gold holdings, that's more than the 27 top central bank gold holders in the world. If you have a look at the importance of the Shanghai Gold Exchange, which is 100% physically backed, then I think I said that at the beginning already. Well, we Western guys and girls, we should focus much, much more on all those developments in the gold world happening in Shanghai, in Mumbai, in Dubai, for example. That's really where the gold flows are heading to. While, you know, over here, big banks probably say, yeah, you have to have some 2 or 3% gold allocation in your portfolio. Well, I'm not sure about if that's the right allocation. So obviously, when it comes to the whole de-dollarization topic, it's a very, very complex, it's a very political development that we're seeing. But all those things that we and Luke Roman, for example, forecast for quite a while now, they're happening. We are seeing that, you know, the BRICS will be discussing a BRICS currency at their next meeting in summer. We saw that Sergei Glasyev, he was talking about the gold ruble 3.0. We are seeing that three out of the top five oil exporters are actually big buyers of physical gold at the moment. So all those little tiny pieces are clearly going into that direction. However, I still think that, you know, it's naive to believe that, well, you know, the renminbi will be the world reserve currency very soon. That's not going to happen, because obviously the Chinese have their own problems. But we have seen, for example, that the US dollar and the British pound were basically walking side by side as the world reserve currencies for almost four decades. And I think that the renminbi, for example, is more and more being accepted as a trade currency, not really as a reserve currency yet, because, you know, they don't want to open up their capital accounts, they don't want to float their currency and so on. But I think the infrastructure and all those small agreements, those bilateral agreements, there's just so much going on that actually this year in the chapter about de-dollarization, we called it the final showdown, and we quoted Xi Jinping in his farewell to Vladimir Putin on March 22nd, when he said, right now there are changes, the likes of which we haven't seen for 100 years, and we are the ones driving these changes together. So this is clearly happening. We discussed this topic with Russell Napier, for example, where we said, well, actually, perhaps gold could be labeled as, you know, kind of a narrative being created by the Western world, that gold is something that only, you know, the bad guys, the Putins and so on, kind of like. And this could be quite a powerful narrative, like a bit similar to Bitcoin, which started out as a you know, libertarian cypherpunks a currency, and then it has been labeled as a, you know, only being road for Silk Road transactions, and then the next narrative were, well actually it needs way too much energy and pollutes the environment. So I think this could be quite a powerful narrative when it comes to gold, and it might even impact prices for a while. This narrative that, you know, the bad guys will be using gold to kill our currency system.
Ronnie, you've also got a section in the report about the shift in gold demand from west to east. Now, is that central bank demand or retail demand or, you know, institutional demand? What kind of demand are we talking about that's moving from west to east?
Well, I think it's a trend that is really important. We're seeing it, you know, in 2008, 2009, we saw the big pivot. When up until then, Western central banks were selling gold. We saw the infamous brown bottom. We saw all the central bank gold agreements, where the Western central banks, you know, reduced their gold holdings. And then on the other hand, Eastern central banks started purchasing gold, started diversifying out of the U.S. dollar, and so on. So this is the central bank side. But then also when it comes to consumer demand, I mean, you know, China, for example, in the year 2000, they were responsible for 8% of consumer demand. Now they're being responsible for 25% of consumer demand. The only Western nation where consumer demand, so this is like the, you know, retail demand, yeah, for bars, coins, and so on. So the only Western nation where consumer demand really picked up significantly is Germany. So they are now almost 6% of all consumer demand. And that's probably the reason for that is probably because, you know, for the Germans, but also for us Austrians, we've got, you know, the hyperinflation in our monetary DNA. So, you know, our grandparents, they tell us about the currency reforms, the hyperinflation, and you often get like little gold coins as a gift for your birthday and for Christmas and so on. So we're still massively influenced by this hyperinflation and all those currency reforms that we saw over the last, or that our grandparents saw. But beside Germany and also to some degrees Austria, basically all Western nations, you know, gold demand basically stagnated. While, as I've said, you know, India is now 23%, China is 25%. We're seeing countries like Turkey, but also the Middle Eastern region becoming much more important. And I think, Eric, what's really important is to also have a look at the gold trading infrastructure with the Shanghai Gold Exchange, with the India International Bullion Exchange, but also the Russian gold market infrastructure, where quite a lot of things happened. They are now introducing, you know, Moscow World Standard to kind of compete with the LBMA. We're seeing that there's quite a lot of movement when it comes to corporations between the Russians and the Chinese in gold trading infrastructure. So there's quite a lot of stuff going on, and it's probably also no coincidence that there's quite a lot of geostrategic central bank gold buying from, all those nations in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, in the BRICS, in the Belt and Road Initiative. All those nations that are now becoming more and more aligned, they're pretty significant gold buyers. And I think, once again, we tend to underestimate the importance of those markets and also how they behave when it comes to gold. For example, the Indian are pretty contrarian gold buyers. You can also always see when a gold price in rupee terms is rising too much, well, actually start selling. And when it's falling, they start accumulating. So that's some things where we said, well, actually it's very much underappreciated in the Western world. So really, let's focus more on what's going on in those nations where gold is much more of a, like, let's say, inflation hedge, a monetary hedge. And therefore, this is really one of the core topics of this year's report.
Ronnie, let's go back to the gold mining stocks that we talked about a little bit earlier. I really caught my eye in the report to see the ESG section, because at first I thought, okay, obviously ESG, the mining is a very environmentally damaging industry. It must be the environmental concerns they're talking about. No, you're talking about the social component, the S in ESG, not the E in ESG, related to gold mining stocks. Why is it the S and not the E that we're talking about?
Well, we covered the topic of ESG already for a couple of years. I think we started in 2019, and everybody is talking about the E, so the environmental aspects. But I've visited many gold mining projects, and I think if you hear gold mining, the perception and the image that is coming to mind is almost always a negative one. So from my point of view, if you have a look at the social aspects of mining, what it does to communities, of course, there's some really bad examples. But in general, I think that most of the companies really do a great job in providing infrastructure, hospitals, schools, in providing access to clean water, roads, electricity, and so on. So I think it's really something that is vastly underreported. Now, we say that, well, actually, what's going on with all those nationalization campaigns? Well, actually, I think it's a challenge for the mining space, but we always see, for example, in Latin America, well, it's the pendulum is swinging to the very, very left politicians, and then it's swinging back because they realize, well, actually, mining and natural resources are just crucial for their economies. But I think that, co-ownership is really something that works pretty well. And we're discussing some examples where actually the community gets a certain part of the mining project or the revenues. And then you can see lots of positive effects. So I think that most people criticizing mining and that now coming up with, green metals. So for some reason, copper or lithium or cobalt or nickel are greener than gold, for example. I think most of those people have never visited a mine, have never talked to the people in the community. Of course, there's negative aspects, but I think in general, the positive aspects of mining are overwhelmingly bigger than the negative aspects. So, and I think, as far as I know the companies, and we do like 120 management meetings on average per year, I would say that the companies really care about that because they know if they screw it up, their share prices will be impacted by that. So I think that's something that's really important to communicate. And I think that the gold industry could definitely do better in that aspect.
Ronnie, I want to shift gears now and talk about the market outlook as well as trading strategies, because I think you and I are very much in agreement that in a big picture perspective, the fundamentals couldn't be much better for gold. But you know what? I'm reminded of one of my favorite Jim Rogers quotes. It was something Jim said to me, I think, in the very first episode of Macro Voices, which is, look, the problem when you have a market where the fundamentals are just so clear that it can't possibly be a loss is that it's so clear that all the dummies get it too. And as soon as all the dummies get it, that puts everybody on the same side of the boat. And as soon as everybody's on the same side of the boat, it doesn't matter that they're right. It means at least some of them are going swimming before this is over. This ride ever since the 6th of November, frankly, has been too easy. A lot of us making a lot of money on gold, and that leads to a crowded trade. Everybody's on the same side of the boat. We had Tian Yang on a couple of weeks ago describing a bubble indicator that they use at Variant Perception, saying that just fired, you know, two Fridays ago. Sure enough, he called the top of the market almost to the dollar. We're 100 bucks lower already. We just bounced off of the 100-day moving average. We're recording this on Monday, a few days before our listeners will hear it, so the market may have moved since then. I do think there's a bit of an anomaly in that because it was also a contract roll, and interest rates are back, so contango is back. So I'm not sure how long this bounce will last. But if we break this 100-day moving average, this key support right around 1942 that we just bounced off of to the downside, seems to me there's not a lot more under it from a technical perspective for about 100 bucks more to the downside. And frankly, a washout like that to shake the weak hands out of the market kind of makes sense. Seems like it fits the narrative to me. And I would also recall that back in 2008, and I'm not saying that this coming recession is going to be a 2008-sized market event. I think it'll be smaller than that. But what happened in 2008 is all the gold bugs said, okay, this is bad for the stock market, but the fundamentals are really good for gold. And they were right, the fundamentals are really good for gold. But in a market panic, everybody sells what they can, not what they want to. Gold sold off hard, and a lot of gold bugs got shaken out. I just have the heebie-jeebies. Feels to me like something is just too easy here and about to break. How do you see it as a fund manager?
Well, from a fund management perspective, we have, you know, we put in some stop loss orders in the mining space. We have reduced our positions over the last couple of weeks, actually. And I would agree with you. And you know, if we have a look at the sentiment, for example, commitment of traders report, but also, for example, sentiment trader and some other indicators. I would say they're kind of in a neutral position. It's not from a contrarian point of view. It's not a screaming buy, but it's not super, super overvalued. From, let's say, anecdotal evidence, I can tell you, Eric, that I gave a keynote at Denver Gold Show conference in Zurich. And actually, it was, you know, it was like end of March, beginning of April. So gold was like, I don't know, 50 bucks below its all-time highs. And it was almost empty. People in the gold industry really were kind of negative, kind of pessimistic. So I think, you know, if people in the gold industry and in the mining industry, even though we are just only slightly below all-time highs, if they're that pessimistic, I think that's a pretty good sign that we are far away from all-time highs. I mean, imagine if Bitcoin is trading a couple of percent below all-time highs. What's going on at those Bitcoin conferences? So that's a pretty good setup from my point of view. Can we go 100 bucks lower? Definitely. I think from a seasonal point of view, the next couple of weeks will be tough. Normally, mid-July, beginning of August, better seasonal setup starts. And, you know, in the report, we've got a couple of really interesting new indicators. And on the last couple of pages, for example, we showed the U.S. 2 years versus gold. And normally, you know, the 2 years, they exploded to almost 5% at their peak. I mean, who would have imagined? But normally, each time the two-year yields fell from significant highs, the gold price began an impulsive bull market phase. And I don't think that we will go above those 5%. I think for yields, we have seen the peaks. So therefore, can we go 100 bucks lower? Definitely. Of course, if we have a look at, you know, risk appetite, for example, the gold silver ratio, it's not very, very bullish. If we have a look at the mining space, we don't really see a lot of interest in the mining space. So we are now a little bit in no man's land, I would say. But being in no man's land at those price levels, I feel pretty comfortable, to be honest. And I think it's basically clearly telling me, well, you know, our recession call is playing out pretty well. Because commodities, if you have a look at commodity performance, I think they're clearly telling us that a recession is building. Have a look at those charts. I mean, they really look destroyed over the last couple of weeks. So once I think recession is being discounted, I think that the price of gold should stabilize around those levels. And once I think the market realizes that the emperor, being the Federal Reserve, has no clothes, I think this will be the point in time when gold really starts picking up momentum. And that's going to be the point in time when this huge cup and handle pattern will basically be dissolved. And I think, as I've said before, so many players are waiting on the sidelines. Gold ETFs, for example, they've been really, really no inflows recently. I think everybody is really waiting for this momentum breakout over new all-time highs. Once this happens, I think it can be pretty explosive rally. And I would say that it's probably going to start late summer, early fall. I think that would be my guesstimate. So for the next couple of weeks, I think it will probably be a tough trading sideways environment. We will probably test the lows. I don't expect an immediate breakout at the moment.
Ronnie, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, I want to switch gears completely here because almost everybody knows you as the man behind the In Gold We Trust report. A lot of people don't realize that you're a fund manager and you've had some pretty spectacular performance. Now, as a manager of a hedge fund, for regulatory reasons, you are not permitted to tell our listeners that you've had a couple of triple-digit annual returns in there. But I'm retired. I'm no longer regulated, so I can say whatever I want. So don't say that, but what do you want to say about how people can contact you if they're interested in learning more? Of course, your fund is only available to accredited investors who are eligible to invest in hedge funds. But for those folks, our institutional listeners and accredited private investors, how do they contact you and how do they get a tear sheet to learn more about Incrementum's funds?
Well, actually, we run a couple of strategies. We're a boutique. Absolutely. We run investment funds. I would say most of them in the commodity space, absolute return space. We've got precious metal strategies. We've got strategies where we combine real gold with Bitcoin, for example, with an options overlay. Some of them are AIF, so kind of hedge funds, but the majority of our strategies are UCITS funds, so they are actually also available for the retail crowd. And yeah, all information is on our webpage, incrementum.li. Of course, there's also an English version of that. And yeah, just have a look at the webpage or, you know, drop me an email, contact me via Twitter. I'm pretty active tweeting out charts, not only from the Gold We Trust report, but also, you know, lots of macro stuff. So yeah, contact me anytime. I think we've delivered some spectacular results, especially last year, which was a really tough environment. And that's probably when it's, or as I said in an interview recently, well, you know, if the being an Austrian, of course, I'm going skiing all the time. But when the snow is fine and the weather is fine, everybody tends to be a good skier, even the Dutch and the Germans. But when it's icy, when it's foggy, when it's steep, then you can really tell who's a good skier and not. And it's the same with asset management. So I think last year, we with our performances, we really showed well. When it's tough out there, we reach our peak performance. So yeah. Have a look at our webpage, drop me an email, and I'm happy to have a chat.
Patrick Ceresna, Nick Galarnik, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric. I really enjoyed that interview with Ronnie. I'm looking forward to talking on some of these charts with you, particularly on gold. Now, joining us again in the post-game segment is Nick Galarnik. Now, let's get to the chart deck. Listeners, you're going to find the download link for the post-game chart deck in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the red button over Ronnie's picture that says looking for the downloads. Eric, we got to talk crude oil about this breakdown. What are you thinking here?
EIA inventory was delayed by the holiday this week and wasn't available at the time of recording. We'll have that data for you next week. There was a big tumble in oil prices on Wednesday as economic weakness and recession signals abound. But hang on, OPEC Plus is meeting this weekend, and a lot of people have speculated that they're going to smoke the shorts with a surprise cut in production. Now that sets up a move potentially at the futures open on Sunday night. If they do make a surprise production cut announcement, it's almost certain to jerk the market higher, but there's a whole bunch of people, myself included, that are taking long positions in anticipation of that possibility. And, you know, if it doesn't happen, that means everybody is going to be selling into thin liquidity as futures open on Sunday night. So it's very likely that we'll get a gap up or down in one direction or the other on Sunday based on whether or not OPEC makes a surprise production cut announcement. I also want to point out that several analysts, including our own good friend Anas Al-Haji, said months ago that they didn't think the crude oil price recovery was going to happen in the first half of the year when I thought it was going to happen, but they said in the second half of the year it probably would, and they said June is about when they expected things to turn around. Okay, well, it's the 1st of June. Let's see what happens.
Yeah, on page two, I have the crude oil chart with the 200-day moving average on there. And one of the interesting things was I kept highlighting this kind of $74 to $75 area, which I viewed as the bottom end of the high volume trade range that has been established through the first quarter into the second quarter of the year. And when we broke down below there and then rallied in, technically, there's that saying of what was previously support now acts as overhead resistance. The fact that crude oil rejected there just solidifies that the prevailing downtrend is still the path of least resistance. Now, while we may be edging towards where the ultimate bottom will be, and there probably is a key buying opportunity down here, but the way I view it is at the minimum a retest of the previous low and even a shoot down below $60 on a temporary basis are all immediate short-term risks. Ultimately, out of all of this will come a big buying opportunity, but technically, there's no evidence that this is imminent or is going to happen now. So let's continue to see how this plays out as we approach those lower levels. Inevitably, the OPEC Plus could become a catalyst, so that'll be interesting to see whether that does play out that way. Nonetheless, let's get to equities. What are you thinking here, Eric?
I'm still optimistic that a done deal on the debt ceiling is going to bring an excitement rally that takes us up, hopefully, to 4309, because that's my short sell point. But I'm guessing that that's probably going to be the last hurrah for this bear market rally. Obviously, that's pure speculation on my part. I don't know what's going to happen, but that's where I'm placing my bets.
You know, I agree with the idea that we can head up to the still make a higher high. But let's first start off with taking a look at the levels. Nick, let's get you in this conversation. And what are the option levels that you're watching here?
Spot price right now is 4180 on SPX. We have a call wall above at 4300 and a put wall below at 4000, which is also heavy support. The implied move for the June 16th OPEX, which also factors in the FOMC meeting, is 110 points in either direction. So the upper expected move is 4290, just below that key level of 4300. And the lower expected move is 4070, just above that key level of 4000 or so. Key resistance above is 4200, then 4300. Key support below is 4150, 4100, 4050, and then a key level of 4000. Now, looking ahead for the next couple of weeks, we have FOMC in 2 weeks' time. And currently, the probability of a 25 basis point hike stands at 34.3%. So about a one in three chance that we see that hike coming in a couple of weeks. So I expect some volatility to pick up into that OPEX. We've ran pretty hot and on the back of a few key names like NVIDIA, Meta, Google, and Microsoft. So again, I'm still very, very short-term bullish. I think we can tap that 4,300 level, but I don't think we'll have much more gas beyond that.
You know, Nick, what's interesting to me is obviously the debt ceiling resolution has really kind of created a pop and drop earlier in the week. But certainly, I was expecting at least a bit more of a reaction bullishly on the news. The window remains quite open for a S&P to rally to 4,300. But really, the momentum is lost in the S&P, and it's almost all completely evident in the NASDAQ alone. The S&P 500 equal weight continues to drag to edging lower. Than the Russell continues to be at the bottom in the ranges. You see a very heavy Euro stock 50 index. Overall, equities outside of the NASDAQ are already very, very heavy. One of the levels to watch, I just put that 50-day moving average on here. I think that any breakdown towards 4,100 would be really the technical advertisement that a short-term high is in. But so long as the pattern of dips are being bought that has literally been dominant since March continues, then we just have to respect that the bulls currently remain on the short term in control. I'll be looking for the transition moment, but it just hasn't appeared yet. But let's move on page five to that NASDAQ, because this thing just keeps ripping. Obviously, you're watching some of these key levels. What are the options telling you?
So the spot price right now is 348. The call wall above is at 360, and there's a put wall below at 350 or so. We have a implied move right now of plus minus 12 points for the June 16th OPEX. So the upper expected move is 360 and the lower expected move is 336. Key resistance is just above at 350, then 355, then 370, and key support below is at 335. And again, given that we've ran pretty hot on the back of a few key names, I do think that a pullback is warranted, especially once those names cool off. NVIDIA in particular strikes me as a pullback candidate, given how hot it's ran. You know, it's gone from about 170 to $400 in you know, less than half a year. And the fundamentals don't really support that. You know, Ray's guidance, in my mind, does not support a valuation where they're trading at a PE right now of 200 or so. I don't see that as being feasible in the longer term. And I do think the AI hype train has kind of left the station, and it might leave a lot of bag holders, kind of like we saw with the crypto boom a couple of years back as well.
Yeah, you know, I have to agree. But the one thing is that sometimes when this kind of momentum and flow is coming in there, trying to rock star where the actual high is going to come in is always tricky. While I generally think that this is going to lead to some sort of blow off that leads to a pretty deep mean reversion, sometimes you don't want to get in its way. And there's still, I think, room for the market to squeeze out shorts that are too ambitious too early. But certainly, this is a customary bubble chart that ultimately will deeply mean revert when the momentum runs out. Nonetheless, I want to move on to page six, where we got the volatility index, and clearly volatility is very benign at the bottom end of the ranges, and that volatility premium is not being grabbed at very much in terms of hedging out any downside risks. What are you thinking here?
Well, we've seen the VIX tap 20 a couple of times in the past few weeks and bounce right back off of that level, go back to about 17 or so. So it seems that volatility is remaining suppressed in the short term. Once we get more clarity on the debt ceiling crisis and FOMC in a couple of weeks, it's possible that we see a nice big move in either direction, either up, in which case we would see the VIX decline down to around 15 or so, or perhaps a pullback toward that 4,000 level, in which case probably see a pop in the VIX to around 22 to 25 or so. Again, I don't put as much weight in the VIX anymore as I did previously in years past because of the proliferation of the zero DTE options, which are taking a lot of liquidity from the average 30-day DTEs, which the VIX is predicated upon, and moving them to the zero DTE instead. Now, moving on to the US dollar index on page seven, what are you guys thinking here?
Well, we've been steadily climbing up towards that key resistance at 105 on the Dixie, actually 105 and a half, where it topped out on the last cycle. So for now, we're still just consolidating. But the time has come to watch this market closely for what happens when the Dixie gets to 105, or particularly 105 and a half. The action there is what's going to bring the next leg.
Yeah, Eric, overall, my theme over the last several months has been that the dollar will be far more trade range bound than it would be downtrending. And that has really materialized. But my view here is that the dollar could actually have a bullish upside break, but it will only come on the back of a real kind of risk-off impulse. I still think the dollar will play its typical role of strengthening in a period where everyone is getting out of most risk assets. And so will that start here, let's say, on the jobs numbers, or will it still be a month or two away, maybe the July earnings or something like this? We are likely to remain in this trade range bound, and resistance will be there until I think something breaks. And when we really see the stock market at some point go through a deeper correction is where I would look a little bit more bullishly at this.
Now, guys, moving on to page 8, we have the chart of the gold futures. What are your thoughts here?
Obviously, we already talked about the fundamentals for gold since that was the topic of our feature interview with Ronnie. So I'm going to focus on a technical anomaly in the gold futures term structure that most non-professional futures traders probably won't be aware of, and I think is very relevant to the chart right now. If you look at the continuous futures chart, which almost everyone uses to quote the price of gold, it looks like gold held that critical 100-day moving average support and turned back up quite sharply. That continuous contract futures chart is really looking great right now, with gold having already navigated back above the short-term moving averages and giving the impression that the bottom is in and we're headed back up toward new all-time highs. What's not so obvious is that almost all charting programs will have rolled from the June delivery contract to the August delivery contract this week. Now, for the last few years, it was safe to just ignore these contract rolls. The price for the new contract is generally higher for these rolls than the expiring contract. We call that phenomena contango. Interest rates play a huge role in determining contango, and since interest rates have basically been zero for the last 5 years, it was easy to get complacent and just forget completely about the effects of contango in the continuous futures chart. After all, the price difference was only a dollar or two. But now interest rates are back, and so is contango in the gold market. The August contract is trading at a premium of almost $20 over the June contract. And because the contract roll happened just as the June contract hit that 100-day moving average, it makes the chart look like gold is already $40 higher than where it bottomed. That's an illusion. At the time of this recording, it was only $20 higher than where it bottomed, even though the price on the chart is $40 higher. It's because of the contango differential due to the contract roll. So my point is, don't get too excited quite yet about what looks on the continuation chart like a robust recovery. If you take a look at the August contract chart only, you'll see that it paints a slightly less bullish picture. We're still holding the line on that key support. We haven't moved below it yet, but we're not out of the woods either. And as Ronnie said in the feature interview, another $100 of downside is still entirely possible from here. And if it happens, it doesn't invalidate the bull case. It's just part of the way markets work.
You know, I find it really interesting, Eric, that gold, this pullback actually mirrors very similar to the pullback we had in February. It just poked down to a 50% retracement, just temporarily below its 50-day moving average. And when this happened back in March, it started a new bullish breakout move on the upside. Now, rarely do things happen exactly the same, so I'm not trying to use that analog, but what will be really interesting to see is what the bulls have here. I mean, if we see that the bulls can, let's say, clear 2000 with some momentum, maybe what will happen if they go for a double top retest of the highs, or is there enough fuel for them to go and even break gold to higher highs in this sequence, will tell a lot. If we see that the bulls here are struggling to hold on to gains above the 2000 level and then it rolls right back down, then that could really start that kind of a bigger correction that Ronnie was even mentioning inside the interview. And so I think that watching how the gold traders play it out this week is actually going to give us a lot of, or at least in the upcoming week, will give us a lot of insights as to what's next here, at least on a short-term basis. Nonetheless, I wanted to wrap up by just looking at the Bloomberg Commodity Index. I'm looking at it through the ETN symbol DJP. And what I wanted to simply highlight is that while we mess around looking at these charts on individual commodities, there is no denying that the commodity index has been in a decisive bear downtrend for now an entire year. It was June of last year that it put in its peak, and we have seen since then a very decisive downtrend, very clear lower highs, lower lows, and a perpetual downwards channel. The question, of course, is when does this downward channel finally come to an end? The interesting part is that I don't necessarily think this will end with a V bottom, and therefore we might even be going through a prolonged bottoming formation along the downside, even when the ultimate low is put in. We may not be seeing a major turn in this commodity index until the fourth quarter of the year even. When we do, I think it will be an extraordinary buying opportunity. But right now, just this chart continues to demonstrate such distinct weakness, and patience is what's needed here at this level.
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks every week here on Macro Voices, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The details are on the last pages of the slide deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
In this week's Research Roundup, you're going to find a transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the In Gold We Trust report, as well as the chart book we just discussed here in the postgame, and a link to a number of articles that we found interesting. So you're going to find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, that is Eric spelled with a K, and follow Patrick at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna, and myself, thanks for listening and see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.